Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Hi, it's Mark Graben. Welcome to episode 496 of the podcast. It's January 17th, 2024. Our guest today is Randy Carr, the CEO of World Emblem. Today, we are discussing nearshoring, or the approach for bringing production back closer to U.S. customers. We're going to talk about his company's lean journey and his role in leading it. So you're going to learn more about Randy in a minute. We're going to have a great conversation here over the hour. To learn more, to find links to Randy's company and more, look in the show notes or go to leanblog.org/496. Our guest today is Randy Carr. He's the CEO of a South Florida-based company, World Emblem. They're one of the largest embroidery companies in the world with plants in the U.S. and Mexico. Since 1993, this family-owned business has been the go-to for emblems and patches, for sports headwear, footwear, sports garments, and other apparel with an output of more than 100 million products a year. So Randy, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's such a great opportunity here today to explore your lean journey, personally as a CEO and as a company, to talk about nearshoring, talk about a lot of important issues here. And, we had agreed, at least roughly speaking, we're going to try to structure the conversation a little bit like an A3. So, Randy, let's start, in the upper left corner, kind of tell us some of the background of World Emblem. Like, what was some of the situation and some of the need for change a couple of years ago?
Well, I think that we're really grounded in kind of two parts. The first one was really coming out of COVID, but even before then. So I'll just go like before COVID. We really didn't have good cost control. That was the number one thing. We weren't really improving the business as well as we needed to in order to be competitive. We were having delivery issues. Things were super inconsistent. So we'd be 100% on time one day, and the next day we'd be 50%. So there was a lot of ebbs and flows in the business that we just weren't able to keep up with. Lean wasn't the answer at that time. I mean, it probably would have answered the question had I asked the right question and kind of gone down that path. But it was really not having the right management system in the business. And I don't mean like ERP. I mean the management system to like Lean, to operate the business across all of our locations and all the facilities. And then the second part of your question, or the second answer to it, was just coming out of COVID. I think we sort of knew, and it was fairly obvious coming out of COVID, that there was going to be the need to staff. The need to get more people, and we were going to need to pay more. And we knew that price increases weren't going to be enough in order for us to chase the requirements to pay our staff more, the inflationary requirements that were going on all over the place, which wasn't just labor, but labor was the biggest factor for us. So we needed to get more out of what we had. I had a good friend in my YPO forum. And he has been on me, and my COO has been on me about using Lean as sort of his secret weapon, he calls it. So he introduced me to a turnaround firm that does Lean implementations for private equity, and we ended up hiring them. And we just, it was like the best thing we ever did. We found immediate answers to a lot of the problems that even before COVID. And now it's sort of grounding us for what's to come. Hmm.
So going back to pre-COVID, it sounds like, if I hear you right, Lean wasn't part of consideration of what the countermeasures could have been. But if you had learned about it earlier, you could have tapped into Lean earlier, it seems.
I'd like to think I'm that sort of enlightened. Sometimes you need a kick in the face. I mean, COVID was more than just a kick in the face, but I think, it was just the obvious response to needing to get more out of less. And you know, that was it. But no, going into COVID, I would say we had a lot of more operational issues and service related issues. And what we weren't looking at was the management system for the business. We were looking at stuff like technical debt on the IT department was a big topic around here, or a better Salesforce was like the topic. And those were the topics. But the reality is what we had to do was chase. We had to look internally at what we were doing as a management team to resolve the issues.
And it's always tempting to go looking for solutions, even if we're sort of jumping to solutions instead of kind of looking back at the current state or even what you described as a management system. And would you say before the introduction of Lean, was there a consistent system per se, or was there just a lot of management happening? You know,
we had operational, we had KPIs and ways to measure things, but we didn't have a system that was top to bottom. Like, you know, Lean's cliche, like what we call the world level management system now, but it is, you know, we've renamed our Lean journey the world level management system. So I'll use that term interchangeably today. But no, we didn't have a system that really changed the DNA of our staff. We had measuring KPIs, paying for the measurement on the KPIs, but we really weren't changing the culture of the business or just the DNA of the company. So, you know, when we, just to give you a parallel, when we called our consultants in, you know, they gave shock treatment to the business. So they came in and shocked everyone in the organization, and we got the margin we wanted. We got the results of the spend. And when they started to pull out, it just started to backslide. So we never changed the DNA. We were kind of going back into back to where we were prior to COVID. So we had to change course. So the answer is we had systems and we had management systems and we had operating systems, but we never changed the actual business or the DNA of the company. So we weren't getting the long-term health results we needed to get. We were going to the gym, but we weren't eating right. So we weren't creating the right habits in order to make a well-rounded problem-solving machine.
So then your friend from the YPO forum, do you remember how that friend kind of initially pitched you to say, hey, Randy, here's some stuff you need to learn about. Did he have to be a little persistent with you? Or?
Yeah, it's real. No, he didn't have to be ultimately persistent, but I did have to be prepared to spend the money on the consultants. And it was a 7-figure check. So like we had to have, it was a leap of faith to know that, you know, we're going to drop $1 million or $2 million and we're going to get that money back. But the short answer is we did a forum retreat. He's in my forum. We did a forum retreat. Am I okay to say his name here or no?
Yeah, it's up to you. Yeah.
So it's Andrew Koenig, this company City Furniture. It's $1 billion furniture manufacturer in South Florida. He's awesome. Like he's the boss. So anyways, we did a forum retreat in Mexico, and you know, I was all hyped up and proud, and he went down there, and you know, he was complimentary of our facility and everything else, but you know, he then says to me, "You got to look at this." And I had heard of it before, and you know, I had read Paul Acker's book on the 60-second lean, or I think that's the name of it, but
two-second lean.
So, but I had read his book, and I had been toured Nissan and some of these factories, so I had been familiar, but he sort of hit me with it, and I was like, "Yeah, but we're doing this, so we're just as smart. Whatever we're doing is really good." Then I toured his factory, then I toured his facilities, and I was embarrassed.
Hmm.
Then COVID.
Why is that? What did you see as the differences or the opportunity for you?
Yeah, what I saw was alignment. I mean, I saw, for number one, I saw like he had his warm room set up and all the visual tools were there. And then I went around and I saw the sort of visual tools all throughout the organization. And all of them rolled up to what he was doing in the war room. And it like that kind of hit me. And I'd say that was probably a year before COVID. So, and the retreat was probably 2 years before COVID. So, and you know, that it was just layering. And, you know, at some point, like I said, the real impetus was COVID. Where we just had to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. New reality of challenges finding workers.
Yeah. Yeah. It was challenge finding workers. And it was also like we had to give big increases. And like, how are we going to keep our margin consistent with giving big increases. I mean, obviously price increases were there, but they're not 20%. Like, so, I mean, that's, so that spread, we had to make the spread up. We knew there were inefficiencies in the business. The question was just, you know, where, how do you even start? It's daunting with 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. So I want to come back to the getting started, but maybe exploring, you know, there's that possible countermeasure, if you will, and companies, I mean, that we, I think as customers, we're all subject to this. We get the email, we get the letter that says something like, you know, due to wages, due to gas prices, yeah, due to whatever. They'll say what? We're forced. We have no choice but to raise prices. And I always read those and I kind of think, well, BS. Like there are options. There's a choice. You know, going back to like Toyota lean literature, they always emphasize that you're not entitled to raise your prices. If costs are coming up in this one area, you've got to figure out how to reduce them in another area. It seems like you really were pursuing that more Toyota type thinking. We've got to take other costs out, right?
I think it was a combination of both, to be fair. I mean, inflation is a reality. So, you know, when we do now give merit increases or comp increases, we need to find those increases in the business. So we're just not arbitrarily saying, let's give a 3% raise across the board to everybody. Like when we budget for that, we forecast for that, we're also going back and saying, we need to find 3% in the business. But again, like we're on year three of this kind of lifelong journey of being a lean, running a lean type organization like Toyota or like Citi. You know, we certainly are probably like a three-year-old child in our thinking about this entire process, except there's 1,000 of us. Like, I think the power of this thing is getting everybody thinking like that, all 1,000, 1,100 people in the business and all operating under the same beliefs. But to answer your question, yes, we did approach it both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you price to what the market will bear. And I think, you know, look, the market may be accepting of price increases to a point, but I think that's different than viewing it. Like sometimes you get a sense of entitlement of like, well, we're going to raise our prices and of course people will pay it, which might be true until they find alternatives.
Until they don't. Or another product comes out or something else. I think like in our mindset, at least as far as pricing is concerned, the better, and this has been true with our lean journey. So it's not like, but the better we service our customers, the more they're willing to pay also.
Sure.
So regardless of the price, I mean, what we do is pretty unique. I mean, you know, there are days, it's not every day, that we'll do 800,000-900,000 pieces in one day. We'll ship half the order same day and we have one piece minimums. So what we do is it's a low price product with a low margin. It's very, very fast and it's complicated. So, for us to get the margin, it takes a lot of combination of people and technical work and everything else. So, the degree of accuracy that people expect is pretty high. So, you know, for us to be what I would say elite, you know, customers are willing to pay 2 or 3% more if we're 3% more than the nearest competitor, if they know our stuff's going to show up the next day and they don't have to worry about it not showing up. And then you dovetail that with very high quality and dovetail that with sort of an elite customer experience via e-commerce API. And that's kind of our recipes for success.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like even before lean, you know, Randy, you're thinking about your business a little bit more systemically than just looking at cost and price. You know, you're looking at, and you may have been taught the same letters here of SQDC, safety, quality, delivery, cost of all of these things going hand in hand. I mean, it seemed like you were already maybe like thinking about those interconnections.
I was, but I would, like, in full transparency, it was always delivery and cost. And, you know, quality was an afterthought, kind of, not really, but kind of. Safety was an afterthought, not really, but kind of, only when it translated to workers' comp. And it never really sort of the umbrella of kind of all of it. And looking at it, you know, again, getting a new HR director in here the last couple of years, she hit me pretty hard on that one and said, like, getting the turnover down is going to, you know, having those kind of, it's not like we were having injuries because that wasn't the issue. We're not construction, but just calling that number out on all levels, and even something as simple as a dirty kitchen, you know, it's not like, but just calling those things out makes a better work environment, reduces turnover, makes a better, healthier staff. It's just stuff we don't have to think about. And to be fair, like, I'm an owner operator, you know, I started with three people. So, like, you know, my mentality is, oh, something's busted, go to the machine, try to fix it yourself. And that just, so like, it's been, we went through very gritty times and I'm sort of used to that. So for me, it's, you know, get on the machine, get the order out. Like, that's kind of all I'm thinking about. So, but yeah, on the SQDC version, just looking at it now and looking at it every day, it's just much more aware of it than I was at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's the M for, you know, morale that often gets tacked on because, you know, as I learned it almost 30 years ago, SQDC, it was in that order. Morale may have been a little bit more unstated directly. And then I think people like, well, morale is important too. And it's put at the end, not because it's the least important thing. I mean, it's probably one of these things that helps drive quality delivery and cost. Maybe it should be SMQDC.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it goes back to the culture.
And so, we talk about 1,000 people thinking this way. I do want to come back to that a little bit later. But as you were exploring, it seems like kind of the current state and your performance gaps, what are we going to do about it? There was this decision point, as you described it, seven-figure leap of faith to hire consultants. That's a big leap. I mean, that's a lot of money. I'm curious if you don't mind sharing a little bit of, you know, the thought process around, you know, starting with baby steps, reading Paul Akers's book. Let's just start doing a lot of 2-second lean, or, you know, a lot of times companies say, well, we're going to try to do it ourselves. Or what? I'm just curious if you don't mind exploring.
Yeah, of course. It's not going to be anything that's going to be too brilliant. The reality is, I read Paul Akers' book 10 years ago because I saw him at a Vern Ornish talk in Orlando. And I was like, this guy's awesome. You know, I read his book, put the book down, and forgot about it. So, you know, because I picked the next book up and the next book. So it's like one of those things. So, it's nothing more than what I said before. The reality is, we knew coming out of COVID, like, the pie was going to be bigger and we were going to get busy, and we had to do something different. And if we did the same stuff we always did, we got the same results, which would have been 60% on time performance and an increase of cost of 10 points. And we just wouldn't make any money. And maybe at this point in time, you and I wouldn't even be talking. So, you know, it was just, we knew we had to do something, and like, this is the track we took. The ROI was pretty straightforward when the consultants came in and looked at stuff and put on paper, hey, like, this is what we think we can get you. And the one firm we ended up hiring, which was TDM, their analysis was pretty clear. And I'd been around the business forever. So it was like, yeah, that's probably just about right. You know, the ROI was there. It wasn't much more than what I paid. But on year two, that's gravy.
Right. And now you are sustaining and continuing to improve.
Look, you know, it's nothing's linear. So, you know, again, it was like the paddles and shock the business. And it was shock. And, you know, it was one Kaizen after another. And that's kind of all we knew at the time. But there was no problem solving or none of that. You know, then we went to the UK route, which was University of Kentucky, called them in, and they hit us from the top down. And that was that's where the sustainment starts. Like, go into the DNA, go into the culture, one voice leadership, roles and responsibilities, problem solving from the bottom up. yeah, Kaizens are awesome too, but I think it all kind of works together. And that was kind of the second breakpoint, where it was, you know, doing the Kaizens, getting the money out, taking that money and reinvesting it in the training from the top down, and go deep into the DNA of the business and really start changing the way everybody operates and thinks about everything. And like, you know, imagine how powerful it is to have 1,000 people solving a problem a day. Like that's the power behind that is unbelievable. Now we're not close to that. We probably have 8 people solving problems every day.
Okay. So there's still a gap to work on.
The gap is huge, which is awesome because all that's opportunity and margin and opportunity for our customers to benefit and opportunity for our staff to benefit and growth for the business. And so it's just, thank God we have those gaps.
Yeah. And so, you know, it sounds like you have the, maybe there's a parallel between reading a book about fitness, of which Paul has written a book called Lean Health, reading a book versus having a trainer who can kind of help, kick in the butt, make sure you're taking action, give you feedback. There's value in that, right?
I use the trainer parallel to my staff. And I said, like, our lean journey has been the equivalent of hiring a trainer. And then you fire the trainer and you stop going to the gym. That was my example. It's exactly the same example I used to my staff. And I was like, we hired a trainer. We did 90 days of workouts. He leaves. And we go back to skipping a day or skipping 2 days and eating bad. And it's, I mean, you know, a healthy lifestyle is just that. There's a balance of all these things. And this is the same. It's exactly the same thing. You know, reading the book is like the kindling, the 1%. I mean, look, the book was great. And I saw him speak and he was great. And everything he said was right. But to try to do it yourself, to me, was just, there's just no way. You could do some things yourself, clean your desk up, which is obvious, but like, you know, to implement SQDC boards and tier 1 boards and tier 2 boards and to run an elite business at the pace we're trying to run, and serving the kind of clients where we have to serve. There just wasn't a 20 years of failure. Like we had to get things straight and we had to do it quick. And again, you came out of COVID and everybody came out like a cannon. You know, it was only till this year things started to drop off and people had to do a reset. And the reset was more on sales and marketing. And we had the same issue. We came into 23 thinking we're going to be like gangbusters. And all of a sudden things started to drop off. I think when everybody else is in February and March. And we just said, all right, let's take these lean principles and let's start moving them into sales and marketing. And we did that. So I brought TDM back in. I brought them into my sales and marketing department. We started doing value stream mapping. And so it's not just production. It's every single piece of the business can be optimized.
Right.
So,
but, I mean, I appreciate how, you know, Randy, you are framing all of this, not in terms of, well, here are the tools and I want to go and implement. Because there's a lot of workplaces. People get started with lean, cleaning up the desk, using lean tools and maybe kind of a superficial or trivial way, where I appreciate your motivation was around, we've got these business challenges and opportunities to solve. Focusing on that seems so much more powerful than say, well, we trained 1,000 people in tools and we had them all go use the tools. Like aiming for that alignment is so much better.
Don't get me wrong. I did that too. Didn't do that. Not with this.
Right.
We went all in. And, you know, I've had people ask me, like, you know, on referral calls, like, we're just going to do one department and we're going to see how it goes. And I was like, you know, for me, it was like, you know, 48 laws of power and Cortez and the whole deal is burn the ships. And for me, it was like, not that I'm burning the ships, but I'm going to spend enough that we're going to get it right. And I knew it was going to work. So it wasn't like there was never a question of whether the money was there, like meaning the margin. Like I knew the gross was there just from being around the business forever. So I wasn't concerned. I knew what the ROI was. So it was like, we're either going to do it or we're not, but we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it 20% and see how it goes. Like it's a, you know, and I didn't know the whole DNA thing either. Like none of that hit me. You know, I've read the Toyota way and the Toyota production system. Was it changing the I feel like it's changing the world, but I have the book name wrong. But Taiichi Ono, I've read a lot of these books at this point. I've read some of them more than once. But I was never under the belief that the DNA thing didn't hit me until UK. And even when I went to UK, the DNA thing still didn't hit me until I hired him as a coach. And I sat through LELI and I sent people to leadership conferences. And it's really just a question. It's not a question of spending the money. It's just a question of going to the gym every day and dieting right every day and meditating for 10 minutes every day. And like, you know, it's one thing to discipline yourself. It's another thing to discipline 1,000 people in the same methodology.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, these different approaches fit together where some of these approaches might be helpful, but not fully sufficient, you know, training lots of people in some tools, doing a lot of Kaizen events,
right.
You know, that, you know, these different strategies can fit together. And it sounds like the UK, is it fair to say working with UK, did that help create a more coherent future state vision of a management system and a company culture that doing a bunch of events maybe couldn't deliver?
It did exactly that. Like, and again, like it did that. And I happen to have a very good COO and I have a good CI guy. And you know, we collectively said, this is the way we're doing business. So the other thing is we were real clear, like not whatever they say goes, but whatever they say goes. Like, you know, it wasn't, yeah, it was like, this is what's happening. Like, this is happening. You're either on board or, you know, maybe there's a better place, another place to work for you. And, you know, I didn't quite have to speak it like that because I didn't have to. But I, you know, we didn't lose anybody and everybody's on board. And there are some people that are further behind than others in their development for whatever reason. But again, like, got to change 1,000 people's mindsets, got to change their DNA. And we expect it to take time. And there's a lot of learning and we're still learning like so much.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you when you talked about the shock of getting started. Sometimes that shock leads to people saying, well, I'm going to get off this bus. And you're saying, no, you didn't lose anybody. We're like, no, this is not for me. I'm leaving.
Look, I didn't lose anybody on my leadership team. Some people might have left or sort of found new jobs. And maybe it's because of COVID or whatever. I don't know. Like, but I can tell you that we hit the shock super hard. It wasn't in life. Like we hit it as hard as we could and as fast as we could. And we did it in 3 locations at once. And again, it was coming out of COVID. So we knew like we had to do stuff right away. It wasn't like, and we did put the pressure of, there was the pressure of, and I don't want to say like the fear of this, and this, but there was the immediate pressure that we knew we had to get a lot quick because we knew there was going to be a surge in demand. And, you know, obviously looking backwards, there was.
So I think part of the story that we're not done talking lean, of course, and some of this is interconnected, but I'd like to talk more about what your current state had been and what your thoughts were around manufacturing locations overseas versus local or nearshored. Can you talk about kind of that aspect of your business and how you started thinking through that?
I mean, again, it's nothing that's going to be earth shattering, but, you know, just to give you some historical context for 30 seconds, the business, you know, my brother and I grew up around my dad's business and he had an embroidery business in New Jersey and it was relatively successful. And in 1988, it went under and he moved the business to Medley, Florida. And the 3 of us restarted the company in 1990. The company had grown to a couple $1 million and in 2000, he passed away. And then a couple years later, we ended up picking up a sizable contract. And at the time we had moved to North Miami, but we were running 3 shifts and we ended up having some problems with the city because across the street from us was a residential zone. NAFTA had been passed and I went to the city and asked for some help with rezoning and they told me no. So I knew a guy that knew a guy and I met my managing director in Mexico City in 2005. And it was like one of the things that, you know, changed my life. Like there's people that eat your life. This guy changed my life. He's still with me. And, you know, I'd give him a suitcase of $100 million and I'd get back $100 million. He's that guy. Like, and even, it's not just financial trust. You know, I'm giving my kids, I'm gonna get my kid, like I would trust him with anything. So like, thank God he came into my life. But, so anyways, it was after NAFTA was passed and we were really, the play was to arbitrage design work. It wasn't anything more than that. We weren't really trying to build an offshore manufacturing facility to make emblems or compete with China or any of that. It wasn't just not, you know, looking at the world like that wasn't in my, it wasn't in my worldview at the time. But it wasn't his. And I listened to what he said. And we gradually moved certain production lines overseas. And at this point, we have 500,000 square feet there and close to 500,000 in the States. And the the operation of the Quiladora in Mexico is really a standalone business that runs independently and supports the U.S. business. So the answer to your question, the answer, there was a long-winded answer, but the answer to the question that we see at this point is we use nearshore labor where it makes sense. But our whole business is grounded on turning stuff very, very fast. So the things that we do in our facility in Mexico are the things we can do that we have to do that aren't required to be done in 12 hours. So everything we do in the States is a result of that thinking. So there are some other things like people send us headwear or garments and they want us to brand them with our products, in which case we don't send those to Mexico. We'll do them in the States. And we have some software and systems to do that as well. But apart from that, the thinking is straight what I told you, which is everything that has to be done the same day is done in the States. Everything else goes down to Mexico. And I would tell you, like, there are other things we do in that facility also, like tech development. We have a marketing team, a service team, a sales team, a finance group. So, and because of that, the business has grown together.
And so I guess it's a matter of looking at kind of balancing cost, quality, delivery of doing something local. It's faster. It's going to cost more, but for that application, it's okay.
In our worldview, yes. In our worldview, yes. I would say there's no difference in quality of person between the States and what I've seen in any country, but in particular, my experience has been in Mexico. But for us, everything's about speed. Our whole business is built on doing custom stuff, same or next day.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're saying the quality of the product also is comparable.
It all comes down to process. I mean, it's not that, you know, I mean, obviously the people have a huge input in that, but it's about the chain. It's about training the right person on the right process to get the right output. You know, if they fit our core values and they run our process, they'll get the quality. The output will be the same every time, regardless of whether it's in Mexico or anywhere else in the world.
Okay, so let's talk more about, you know, some of the different elements of lean and a management system. And I know for you that includes in part a Hoshin planning process. Can you tell us kind of more about how that works for you and what some of the benefits have been?
Yeah, we have been doing consultant led planning for the last 18 years. We just did we did a Hoshin plan last year, but I would say this was our first one. It was UK led. We had them come in and help us with it. It was completely different than anything else we've done. I think the first thing was all the prep work that went into it. We typically would do the prep work, but wouldn't do it seriously. So we went into the room and we would spend a day fighting over what the priority was. And then we would leave in silos, and that was 15 years worth of annual planning. This year, and I can only, again, I only had a year, so I don't have that much experience under my belt with it, but I can give you my take on it. What I found unique was the prep work. And then the three annual priorities that we left with, were very cross-functional. And they made everybody nervous. So everybody left uncomfortable. And then that was a month ago. Next week, everyone's flying back in. To Fort Lauderdale, where we're based, or Hollywood, Florida, where we're based. And they have what's called a rodeo. And the rodeo is really getting locked in and aligned on everybody's 12-month plan to go back to the three-year goals. You know, we had said we were doing something like this, but we really weren't. Like, this is the first time I can remember where we have three cross-functional goals that make everybody nervous that I'm happy with, that I haven't been involved with the what's called nibawashi, or the back and forth between everybody. I haven't been involved with it the whole time. Now I've injected my opinion in areas on things that I'm not, that I think need to be rounded or clarified. But my team really did the work independently of me. And I'm comfortable saying that we'll leave next week with a very good plan with measurable milestones that we'll be able to do check-ins on every month. And I'm super excited and like really motivated for next year because of it.
Yeah. And when you say those priorities were making everybody nervous, is that because were there stretch goals that people are nervous about reaching?
Yeah. It was a three-year priority, and we're working on the 1 year plan to get us a 3 year priority. So, and they're all doable, which is the nice. They're not like insane. They're just a little bit far out, a little outside of where everyone's comfortable. So, and it came from the group, so it wasn't anything. I didn't come walk in there and say we're doing this, which is what would happen 3 years ago. You know, they would say, this is the sales goal. And I would say, no way, dude, you need another 20% on top of that. And then we'd miss the goal. All the goals from this came from the team. So it's, so there's a lot of ownership from the team. And even from the nibawashi and the rodeo, and when we're done with the plan, they own those plans, which is different. You know, I would be inserting my opinion on everything. In this case, I really didn't have to do that. All I had to do was, again, like I said, polishing edges or sanding boards.
And so it sounds like you're expecting, you know, better alignment. Is it fair to say not just in terms of goals that might cascade across the company, but then also the question of like, what are we choosing to work on in terms of Kaizen events or improvements that maybe more aligned, more focused, like better prioritization, as opposed to a lot of organizations, people are trying to do everything and therefore nothing really.
That's me. That's been my 20 year history.
It's not just you.
My to-do list is like ridiculous. So yeah, the answer is, you know, we have our three priorities are cross-functional. This is stuff we're going to work on. Now there's other things that are going to happen. There's other work. But the question we keep saying that I hear when during the conversation, isn't that your day job? Like, isn't that the reason you have a job? Like your Hoshin work is not why your day job. They're two different things. And the Hoshin work, it's for breakthroughs. Like, and at this level, that's pretty much 80% of their time should be working on breakthrough. And that was there were some moments during the meetings where that was like, people were like, whoa, like you're telling me 80% of my time has to work on breakthrough. Well, how's the business going to grow then?
Well, it's a difference between firefighting and breakthrough activities, right?
Yeah. You got to finish the firefighting stuff, which was, again, like going back to what we said like 20 minutes ago, was the shock therapy, sustainment of the culture, sustainment of the DNA, then go into Hoshin. I mean, I remember 20 years ago, we had a consultant come in and do annual planning for us. He goes, you guys can't plan for an hour, let alone plan for a day or a year. Like we're yelling and screaming at each other across the room. So like we've come a long way.
Yeah. You talk about allocating time. One thing we had talked about, one thing you mentioned when we talked previously, Randy, was allocating your time as a CEO. Like, I'm just curious if you can share perspective of like, how much time are you working on the management system, the DNA, working with customers? How do you decide the best use of your time?
So the first thing I would tell you is the majority of my time should be spent with clients, customers. That's just my personal opinion. And I think the second part of my time means accessible to my team. It doesn't mean managing my team. It just means being accessible. So 30% of my time is with clients. Like that's my number one rule. So, I'll travel with my reps, which is mostly where that comes from. If I have to, like last week, I had to go to I was at a football game in Alabama, and I had one of my reps meet me in New Orleans, and I drove around with him for a couple of days through Mississippi and ended up in Tuscaloosa to see my son. So I'll kind of dovetail trips, spend 30% of my time with my clients. I spend 30% of my time with my team. And I spend 30% of my time on my leadership work, and then 10% for whatever I want. You know, the 10% usually gets consumed with stuff that I don't want, frankly, like my calendar gets filled up, and it's not always like that. But somewhere in between, but I can tell you that the time in front of customers is the thing that matters most, because I can connect through everything that happens in the business and every conversation I have, or every conversation that I'm hearing going on in the company, I can connect back to the customer's experience. And that's really the only reason we're all here and the only thing that matters.
And that customer focus is probably being reinforced by the UK folks. And they're former Toyota, is that right?
They're all former Toyota.
They all are. Yeah. Right. So it's not just process focus, but customer focus, customer obsession even. They're probably reemphasizing the connections there, right?
Yeah. I mean, and this is not to say that every customer is always right, because that's kind of not real either. But there is the focus on the customer experience and what is the customer receiving from the business, and how are we interacting with the customer, engaging from the sales side and the service side and the territory manager side and the package side and the business side, and how does the invoice look? How does it hit the website? Like, what is the standard work for the customer when they sit down in front of their computer and start placing orders? You know, we even go as far as looking at how does the customer interact from when they get the order feeds from their ERP, how does that connect to our ERP? Because there's a lot of waste there. So it's just like seeing all that and putting the investment to go deeper into the customer's world in order to shorten our lead times is going to have the biggest return on our investments. And it's real easy when I see it to get behind the initiatives here, other than just looking at the ROI on paper. So, that's kind of, and to be fair, there's a lot of stuff we don't do that's right. I was in California 3 weeks ago taking pictures of their computer and the product they received and sending it to my COO and saying, like, this is not right. Like, what are we doing here? And yeah, sure enough, he does problem solving. He figures it out. We make an adjustment. Some of the things don't get fixed right away. Some of the things are on the list to get fixed in a year from now. We'll tell the customer, look, this is a known issue in the business and we don't really have a solution for it. We're going to do our best. But at least we're honest about the problems, and we're sort of creating lists of problems that we're deciding what to work on. But I said something a while ago. I said, imagine if we had 1,000 people all solving the problems rather than 8 of us. And that's the power of this whole thing that I see.
Well, I think the way you stated that, people being able to be honest about problems, that's a key part of a lean DNA, right?
Yeah, without question.
And you already touched on something I was about to ask of, we talk about wanting everybody to share this DNA, to be thinking this way. That means extending lean beyond operations and manufacturing and supply chain.
Yep.
You're bringing it into business functions and part of that view of all, everything is a process.
Yep. Yeah. So I can give you a couple examples. The one was what I said earlier, but I have like loads of others, but I'll just start with the one that was so obvious. 2022 was like great for most businesses, but great revenue wise, not great operationally. people struggled a lot with a lot of things, whether it's staffing or infrastructure or whatever, chips. I mean, we didn't have the chips issue, but you know, staffing was a big challenge for us and those kinds of things. We kind of figured it out. We had a good year. And then 2023 comes out and like looking back on it, fairly ignorant, but we should thinking about it now, we never should have thought 23 was going to be like 22. We should have kind of known that there would be a drop off, but whatever, either way, we forecasted and planned like things were just going to be, it was just going to keep cruising and it just didn't obviously. And we didn't have the sales processes in place to make up the slack. So we ended up we had to reforecast twice backwards, and that's no fun. And we brought in the lean consultants, the original ones, to look at our sales and marketing processes from end to end. And we sat in a room for almost a month straight and did one VSM after another. And we're still in the middle of implementing a lot of the work they did, either technically through software solutions or manually where software didn't solve those problems. But we are using the measurement tools we left with and we use them every day. Now, again, sales and customer journeys and the customer incubation time is longer for new customers for new products. So we expect it to roll into next year and sort of we had to reforecast twice, but that's okay.
Yeah. Do you expect with a Hoshin planning process as you're going into 24, are there more frequent touch points where you might say, someone might raise the flag and say, hey, wait a minute, the year is not starting off the way we expected. Do we reforecast? Can you adjust sooner?
We changed our budgeting process quite a bit. So I know your question isn't about budgeting. It's more about is somebody able to raise the flag sooner anywhere in the business? So there's two answers. One, we did change our budgeting process to adjust for what happened last year. So that something else will probably happen, but that same issue won't. I like to think so, but I would say too soon to tell with the DNA. So obviously there's some people that will raise the flag and others that won't. The idea is to get them all to raise the flag. The real idea is to get them all to solve the problems independently without having to raise the flag at all.
Right. Right.
And that is like the utopia of this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, it seems like that balance to be found of people to the front line and not too far above. Becoming better problem solvers, feeling more empowered and doing things. Not everything can raise up to your level or the COO's level, but at the same time, learning when do we escalate something?
Right.
When do we need to ask for help and not being afraid to do that is really key. Even if there's not a physical and on cord for someone to literally pull. It's more that question of saying, hey, I need help. Someone coming in to say, oh, okay, no, I think you can fix that on your own versus, yeah, let me help you.
Yeah, for sure. The coach from UK told me when you're talking to your managers, that what you need to ask them is, what problem are you working on to solve today? Forget any other conversation. He says the only thing you need to ask them is that. Obviously, there's other things again, but I know what he meant. It wasn't literal, but it's like I get on the phone with one of my leaders. It's what problem are you solving today? Mm-hmm.
And I've heard toy to people, there's a variation of that question. I've heard it posed sometimes as, what are your top three problems that you're working on? But either way, it's just kind of try to get a sense of how are you prioritizing?
Right.
And you can't say, well, what are your top three problems? All of them, you know, well, no.
Well, yeah, then nothing ever gets done. But he's been hammering me for that. It's painful, but it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, we can think back to going to the gym, like, sometimes working out causes some pain, but it leads to benefit.
Yeah. What is it? Growth comes from discomfort. Isn't that like a statement? So
yeah. Tear those muscle fibers a little bit to spur some growth, but start to wrap up here. Randy, you shared with us, we didn't follow this strictly as an A3, but it's fine. But you gave us a good comparison of I'm not, no need to apologize. And I kind of drifted away from that a little bit too. But just to recap, I think we have touched on, even if it wasn't completely linear, your current condition, the business challenges, the current state, action plan, and you've shared a lot of that with us. So, you know, I was going to ask, what's on the current action plan for the next couple of years, and how would you evaluate your progress as you continue being a couple years into this lean journey that still keeps going?
All right. So I need to wait till tomorrow, till next week's Nemawashi session to answer that. But that is what's on the action plan. So again, we do have our three priorities. I think I'd rather not just verbalize them, but there is a combination of growth margin and technical wins for the customer. And in the growth, there's a lot of cultural changes. A lot of it comes down to like, how do we onboard customers and employees? How do we make sure we reduce things like that? And those are a lot of what's in the plan. Next week's rodeo will give me the physical action items that I need to work with. And I think my role here is to make sure that I clear out obstacles so that the team's able to work on those and they don't get distracted by other concepts or ideas or fruit that gets placed in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I didn't mean to,
No, you're good.
Shortcut that process that you're going through.
The question's legit. Right, I mean, you know, we intend on growing. We have a lot of new products. You know, we're a technical manufacturer. You know, what we do is simple, but technically we're very strong at it. And so, you know, we invest 9% of our revenue into technology every year, year over year. And I venture to say that not a lot of people in my space do that. We have a couple patents that we're going to be launching next year that we're excited about. Patent products. So, but I think a lot of that, the only way any of that stuff scales is by having a management system in the business that allows it to scale. So, you know, regardless of whether it's one of those three priorities or not, it all kind of rolls back to it.
All right. One other thing I wanted to come back to a little bit was, you know, you talk about the goal of 1,000 people thinking this way and working on problems versus, you know, is it 1,000 yet? It's not. Is it 8? Is it something higher than that? Like, what do you think are some of the next steps in getting that number from 8 to 80 to 480, just to pick numbers? Like,
all right. Off the top of my head, I'd say the first thing is to continue to train on what UK calls a true lean methodology. So it's to continually invest in my leadership team in this methodology. Then from my standpoint, it would be getting the values right, making sure I'm clearly communicating the core values and there's an assemblage of one that has continuous improvement in it, getting the vision clear and clarifying roles and responsibilities throughout the organization so that everybody knows how they interact with the business. You know, making like I typically before this exercise and before this management system, I would drop 4 levels below my job 95% of the time. You know, I now check myself half the time, not always, because that's
new habits.
But I think that's the thing. So it's to continue to train. You know, continue to do the Kaizens, like continue to do the shock treatment of the business. But the reality is it comes through training and working on the DNA. And that's only going to come through changing the culture. And that comes through training. And then consistent reinforcement of, you know, one voice leadership. What are the values of the business? What are the roles and responsibilities?
Well, I think, that's a great note to leave things on here today. So again, we've been joined. It's been a real pleasure. Randy Carr, CEO of World Emblem. You know, a real treat, Randy, to hear from your business challenges and your leadership and your focus around lean. You know, thank you for giving us a glimpse into what you've been doing, how you're thinking about this, and a little bit about what's to come.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you're very welcome. And maybe at some point down the road, it'd be good to check back in on you. You know, you're not accountable to me in any way, but I would just, even if it's a shorter conversation to get an update would be great.
Bro, it's all good. I'm always here. You're always welcome to reach out.
And if I'm down in your part of Florida, maybe I can come. anything firsthand.
Here, Austin, Mexico, Houston, Atlanta, anywhere we have a facility or anywhere in general, actually, just feel free to reach out.
All right. Thanks a lot, Randy. Really appreciate it.
Mark, thanks, buddy.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.